The Florida community of mindfulness is happy to make these talks available to you. If you find this talk to be a benefit, please consider making a donation to support us. You'll find a donation button on the talks section of our website, floridamindfulness.org. Thank you, and may you be happy and free of suffering.
Before we begin the Dharma talk, I just want to check and to ask if there are any questions about the practices. Most important that we understand the practices. So if there anybody has any questions about the practice of sitting and walking, mindfulness of the body breath, how to handle whatever's arising, everybody clear? About how to practice mental tranquility, meditation. If you have any questions, now's the time. Yes. Yeah, so we are all, truly we all actually are part of everything. So, anyhow, that's what we'll be talking about today. I don't need to, thank you. So, if there are no questions, other questions? So today I'm going to read from not well-known, but a very unusual great Zen master, Japanese Zen master of the 17th century. His name is Bunke. I think I've taught on him before. I might have even done retreats in the past. He's quite enjoyable to listen to. How many people here know about Bunke? Oh, some of you do. Good. So just very quickly, Bunke, 1600s, Japanese. Zen master, Zen very well established at that time, lots of stuff going on with Zen, and different sects, different lineages, royal patronage, all kinds of stuff, that sort of organized religions go through over time. And then there's Bunke. So Bunke, he was an unusual guy. He was kind of a misfit. I mean, even in his childhood, if there were a bunch of boys getting in trouble, he was always part of that. He was the kind of guy, when he went to school, challenged the teachers, so he wasn't very popular at school. His father had died, so his older brother was sort of the head of the household, and his older brother always wanted him to shape up, but he wouldn't shape up. And he always just asked questions. He didn't, he kind of questioned authority, we might speak. What does this really mean? He was a dropout, kind of dropped out of school, which was kind of your path to rising in the society. And he got into going around, asking the people who are of knowledge, some of his deeper questions, didn't get the answers, but somehow the sense that in Buddhism, he would find the deeper answers to his questions. And he had various teachers and practiced in different way, but he always had a penchant for solitary practice, retreat practice, and he was kind of a tough guy, so he practiced very hard. So he practiced for many years, really meditating, and just really striving unmercifully, beating his body to submit to his desire for awakening in this way. And eventually he really got himself totally sick, and I think they say, quite sick that he could have even died. He had gotten himself in such a a state. And they say one day, just very sick, when he was in his meditation retreat and in a really dark place, he one day had all this phlegm in his lung, and he spit it out, and he spit it right onto a wall, and he just, all of a sudden, he was looking straight ahead, and he's in that moment of spitting and seeing the globule against the wall dripping, he had a breakthrough. I mean, that was his great enlightenment. I mean, he had others. That somehow in that moment, everything fell away, and he saw the innate perfection of that moment. And he realized at that point that the way he had gone about practicing, striving to get something, was totally wrong. That what he had been striving for was already here. And that's what he awoke to. And so he continued to practice. He continued to find other teachers to deepen his awakening and practice. But eventually he became known and began to attract students and disciples. And after a time became quite well known. And he was known for many things. One, for the simplicity of his dharma. And you'll get a sense of it here. But also that he attracted all kinds of people. I mean, he attracted all the professionals, the monks and the nuns, the professional Buddhists at the time, the Zen people. But he also attracted lots of lay people. Just ordinary people, farmers, tradespeople. I mean, because he just had a very direct way of teaching. And also, he taught in groups. He would kind of have these sessions that would go on for months, or a month, 2 months, 3 months. And he would have large groups of people, I mean, hundreds or 1,500 people who would all come to practice together. And he would give 2-3 talks a day and do lots of dialogues with people. And so that was sort of an unusual way of teaching at the time. So that's Bankei. Sort of Bankei, his Buddhism, actually, he had many disciples. But actually, his school that came from him didn't last very long. And part of that, he was so iconoclastic, and he was so non-institutional, so to speak, that he didn't leave any kind of organization or institution. I mean, he actually he never wrote anything. I mean, most of the things that we know about him were his students wrote down, even though he told them not to. Don't write it. He was like very much in the moment. So some of them did write things down. So we sort of have some records of some of his sermons, some of his teachings, and some of his interchanges with people. But again, there's no current traditional lineage from him. So there are two main translations. This is an earlier one called Bankei Zen, Translations from the Record of Bankei, by Peter Haskell. And Yoshito Hakeda was the editor. And so this is kind of organized sort of in sections where they have little titles to the sections, which is really not the way it was. I mean, it was just sort of an ongoing record of his teachings. I mean, not his formal teachings, but these sermons he would give or these questions and answers, but these people sort of gave them titles. So they're in, so it makes it, and again, I could almost open the book anywhere, so we'll see how we do today. This is so much, so rich. So this is, again, taken from a larger talk he gave. And this part says, what everyone has from their parents innately is the Buddha mind alone. But since your parents failed to realize this, you became deluded too. And now you display this delusion in raising your own children. Even the nursemaids and babysitters lose their temper, so that the people involved in bringing up children display every sort of deluded behavior, including stupidity, selfish desire, and anger. Growing up with deluded people surrounding them, children develop a first-rate set of bad habits, becoming quite proficient at being deluded themselves, and turning into unenlightened beings. Originally, when you were born, you were without delusion. But on account of the faults of the people who raised you, someone abiding in the Buddha mind is turned into a first-rate, unenlightened being. This is something I'm sure you know from your own experience. So you can see, he gets right to the matter at hand, and in very simple, direct language, which is quite wonderful. So I think it is, his teachings are as alive today as they were in the 1600s. So this isn't, you know, his first statement. What everybody has from his parents is the Buddha mind alone. So this is the unconditioned mind, right? The mind that we are all born with. You know, it may be hard for us to believe that somehow we were born, we did not have language. Right? And if you do not have language, you do not have your thoughts. Right? So what he's saying is, we are born unconditioned. And yet, totally aware. But over time, we reflect, we absorb from what's around us. And since what's around us are not enlightened beings pointing out these things to us, we end up totally participating in life the way everyone else is around us, i.e., we become a deluded, unenlightened being with our mind full of anger and resentment and fear and stupidity. And as he says, we develop a first-rate set of bad habits. Is that clear? This is very important. Okay? Because most of us, we identify with who we are. And who are we? We are somebody who has all kinds of bad habits, all kinds of delusions, all kinds of issues, all kinds of problems, right? That's who we are. Because that's how we identify ourselves. And that's how everybody else is. That's all anybody else is talking about. Right? We all talk to each other about our problems, our issues, our right past, present, and future. Isn't that true? So we talk about to each other. So therefore, as he says, we're just gonna, you know, we just are ongoing maintaining, right, this fiction. Rather than understanding, we are intrinsically Buddhas, and we have this intrinsic Buddha mind. Okay? But you probably all know this, right? Your parents didn't give you any delusions, whatever, when you were born. No bad habits, no. So we're talking about really at birth, you know, we didn't get it there. But afterwards, once you came into the world, you picked up all different sorts of delusions, developed bad habits. Right. That which you didn't pick up from outside is the unborn Buddha mind. And here, no delusions exist. So, how do you distinguish? There is your original, bright, aware, knowing mind. The infant knows when it's cold, it knows when it's too hot, it knows when it's uncomfortable, it knows when it's hungry. I mean, there even at that earliest stage, there is basic awareness and knowing. Right? That's kind of our original mind. Original mind means what? The first mind. before all the other stuff began. Before you had a name to call yourself and had you had a name to call anything else. This is your original mind. So everything you didn't pick up is your unborn Buddha mind. And here there are no delusions. Since the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, you're able to learn things. So this original Buddha mind of ours is capable of knowing, of understanding, of being present to that which is around them. So therefore, because this mind of ours has this, you know, capacity, we're able to learn things. Right? So we're not inert. And our minds are very alive and present to what is going on within and around us. So because we have this mind has the capability of learning things, it even has the capability of thoroughly learning all thoughts of deluded behavior. Oh, so we had this innate capacity. And yet, unfortunately, it was used primarily to learn the wrong thing. At the same time, since this unborn Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, when you hear this, now he's talking to the people who are listening to him, you'll resolve not to be deluded. And from today on, cease creating delusion and only abide in the unborn Buddha mind just as it is. Okay? So that's what you need to do. Right? We hear this, we go, oh, now I get it. Way back when I made a fundamental, you know, it's sort of like way back when, right, when I didn't know better, you know, there were these two roads and I thought that one was the better road to take. And that's the road I've been on for the last 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, I don't know, anybody? All right, we'll stop at 80. Years. And now all of a sudden he's telling us, yeah, you've just been on the wrong road. There is another road. Oh, okay. Having been on this one for decades and decades and decades and knowing what this one's like, I'm ready to try another road. Just as before, you applied yourself skillfully to picking up delusions and making yourself deluded. Right? So he's very practical. So, you know, for how many decades it is you've been really working your delusions, right? Picking up every ignorant bad habit and you could find and just endlessly ruminating about all kinds of afflicted things, you know. And you've been very persistent, right? Can you see? So he's saying, yeah. Okay, so I can see you're very skillful at your delusion, right? Now, you'll use the same skill to listen to this and stop being deluded. That's what a splendid thing this Buddha mind is. You see how this teaching, anybody could get this. He's saying, yeah, it's like you have the skill, you've just been using it in the wrong way. Now take the same skills you've learned, you know, that same kind of persistent, consistent working of your, you know, that we've been putting to our delusions, to creating affliction for ourselves and others. Now take that same skill, that same energy, that same intention, that same intelligence, and put it, you know, we might say, to the good of yourself and others. Listen, and you'll realize the preciousness of Buddha mind. It's because you don't realize the preciousness of the Buddha mind that you indulge in self-centeredness, creating delusions that do you harm. So now he gets at a very key point. It's because we don't realize the preciousness of our original mind, of our undiluted mind, of our mind that has no issues, has no affliction, has no suffering, right? Because we don't identify and live from that, we indulge in what? Self-centeredness. Right? So rather than living in our original mind, our Buddha mind, our true mind, we live in what seems to be what everybody else is living in, which is what? The world of ego, the world of self, the world of I, me, mine, and all the drama of self. That's what we've chosen to live in. And so therefore we endlessly have created delusions that do us and others harm. Yet these delusions are so precious to you all, or to all of you, that you actually want to become deluded, even at the risk of your own life. Right? He's going, you know, some people, I mean, they will do things, for, you know, because they think it's the right thing for them to do that actually can bring them harm. Right? That can actually lead to their own death or the death of somebody else. Why? Because they so believe in the rightness of themselves. You know, that's how he goes, and he calls that foolish. Unable to withstand the base impulses produced by your selfish desires, you become deluded. With all delusions, it's the same. And then he goes on to say, everyone insists that the way he or she likes to behave is their innate character. So they can't do anything about it. I mean, does this strike home? Yeah, I mean, everybody says, well, this is the way I am. Anybody ever hear that? Anybody ever hear themselves say it? This is the way I am. I can't help it. This is, you know, this is who I am, right? Accept me as I am. Isn't that true? Isn't that the way we talk? So can't do anything about it. Indulging in self-centeredness because of one's selfish desire, holding on to those kinds of behavior one likes. Instead of doing anything about it, we sound clever and talk about how it's all innate. And then he goes on to say, is there anyone who was born a drunkard, a gambler, a thief? Is there anybody who was born with any of these vices? No, no one's born that way. Once you pick up your taste for liquor, it promptly develops into a drinking habit. And then because of selfish desire, you find yourself unable to stop without realizing you've become deluded. It's only foolishness. So you've no cause to claim it's innate and pass off the blame onto your parents. Interesting, eh? It's sort of like he sort of anticipated Western psychology, you know, by about 400 years. I mean, it was 300, 400 years. So there it is. Innately we are Buddhas, meaning innately our mind is pure, undefiled, free of issues. Because we have taken the way of self, of ego, the narrow road with all its issues and problems and desires, etc., 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 you know, we have now developed this full-blown illness of delusion of self. He's trying to point out to us, and this is, you know, this is not just, you know, wordsmithing. You know, I would imagine that many of you here today believe that your stuff is innate to you. is who you are. And yet he says, that is totally fabricated. Because if that was true, you would have come out that way. Right? You would have come out with all your bad habits. Right? Starting manifesting them probably in the first few months of life. But no, it took time. Right? Think about your own life. Think about your own issues, your own delusions, your own whatever. It took time, didn't it? Right? For many of us, it took, you know, several decades to kind of really get it down. Right? I mean, we had to work at it for 10, 20, 30, 40 years before we really became really good. Getting our pattern of self down so we could enter the world with a very strong sense of me, I, my needs, my wants, who I am, who you are. Right? That took a lot of work, didn't it? And then we forget that we were not born this way. That we might not have been this way when we were 1 year old or 2 year old or 3 year old or seven, that it took time. Things happened. Right? We responded to environments and people and situations. And over time, this self that we are so identified with developed. So now it just kind of rules the roost. He's calling us back. He's reminding us that we are not who we think we are. We are not as we identify. When you hear this, so this message that he's been giving, I want all of you from today on to abide in the unborn Buddha mind just as it is. The unborn Buddha mind, which is that what you have from your parents innately. Then you won't create delusions about anything. And since no delusions will remain, you'll be living Buddhas from today forever on. Nothing could be more direct. You've got to realize this conclusively. Is that clear? I mean, does anybody have any, anybody not get that? You don't get it? Yeah, so there are endless permutations of that. But the bottom line is, it's the instrument that perhaps becomes a little bit defective. The Buddha mind is never affected. I mean, that is basic Buddhist psychology. It's sort of like, with a radio signal or something, the broadcaster is sending clearly. The radio, let's say. People have radios anymore? I don't know. That could be defective, so the sound comes through all scrambled. But the signal is still good. And so you're right. I mean, things can happen in the brain or other ways. But that doesn't mean that the innate awareness, even of that being who's been, sort of affected, you know, sort of physically, organically, is not still pure.
Yeah.
And that's important to understand. And there are actually, I don't know if I'm going to get to it today, where actually people, Bankei was quite wonderful. There's a whole section here about women, because in those days, women may be surprised to find out that in those days there was a belief, sort of going way back thousands of years, that somehow women could not, that you couldn't attain Buddhahood in a female form, right? You could kind of develop yourself, but you could never become a Buddha, right? And there's some wonderful dialogues. I mean, this is the 16th century where Bankei just lays that to waste. You know? I mean, he's quite extraordinary. And he also does it, you know, with people who are blind, other kinds of disabilities. I mean, in this thing, he'll actually say, no, you're still a Buddha. Oh, yeah, you have as much capacity as anybody else. Yeah, so he was very... he was outside of his time in a way. I think maybe because at a very early age we saw he was an iconoclast. You know, he didn't, you know, he challenged the teachers. He challenged authority. So he was, so when he came to realization and he became a great teacher, he didn't really teach within the orthodoxy of his tradition. You know, he really, spoke from his own realization. So this is another. One day the master addressed the assembly. All delusions without exception are created as a result of sense self-centeredness. When you're free from self-centeredness, delusions won't be produced. So again, very simple teaching. What is the cause of my delusions? Self-centeredness. What is self-centeredness? I am centered on myself. We call that egocentricity. But this is a different kind of, you know, we talk about egocentricity like it's unusual. You know, like, you know, it's like only somebody who's really self-centered is egocentric, right? The rest of us aren't. But some people, ooh, they're really egocentric. No, he's using it as like, we're all egocentric. The center of our universe is who? Me. Is that clear? That's what he's talking about. It's a disease we all have. We see everything, every experience, every person, every thought, you know, through the prism, through the filter of what? Self. Yes. Yeah, small self. Yeah. In Buddhism, there's no big self, so it's a little different. But yeah, so self means ego, self. Yeah. When you're free from self-centeredness, delusions won't be produced. Well, that's simple. Right? Can you see how simple this is? Oh, cause of delusions, self-centeredness. Want to not have delusions anymore? Give up self-centeredness. I mean, what could be simpler than that? Right? I mean, I would say what? I mean, maybe a primary, you know, maybe an elementary school education. Right? I mean, you know, how much... You don't need too much education to get that. For example, supposedly your neighbors have a quarrel or having a quarrel. You're not personally involved. You hear what's going on. You don't get angry. Right? Right? Somebody tells you about something that gets them all angry. They're all angry about this or that. Or you hear your neighbors quarreling. Or again, some family member come and tell you what they're all angry about. Right? You don't get angry, do you? No, not only do you not get angry, but you can plainly tell the right and wrong of the case. It's clear to you as you listen who's right and who's wrong. Right? Everybody get what he's saying? You know, When it's somebody else, we are very wise. Right? You know? We can listen to the neighbors quarreling or some friend or family can tell us about this happened, that, and we, you know, we're very objective, right? We're very clear. We're understanding, right? We can see the merits of both sides. Everybody know that, right? See? But let it be something that, concerns you personally, and you find yourself getting involved with what the other party says or does, attaching to it, and obscuring the marvelously illuminating function of the Buddha mind. You attach to it and it's obscure. Before, you could clearly tell right from wrong. But now, led by self-centeredness, you insist that your idea is right, whether it is or not. Becoming angry, you thoughtlessly switch your Buddha mind for a demon's mind. And everyone takes to arguing bitterly with each other. Can you see? I mean, you're getting a flavor of Bankei? I mean, very simple and yet very direct. So he points out to us, in case we don't get it, you know, about this self-centeredness. He says, look, same situation. Over here, other people are in the same situation. How are you? Clear-headed, objective, no emotionality, wise, right? Everybody know that? Everybody know that in themselves? Right? But let it involve me, right? Let it have happened to me. Let somebody have done this to me, said this to me, not done this, right? Right? To me, then what? I'm hurt, angry, disappointed. Right? Well, that's interesting. What's the difference? You see? Well, there's a big difference. What is it? What? You're me. That's the difference. But it's the same situation that over here is happening to somebody else, and we're so wise and objective and impartial and fair-minded and unemotional. But when it happens to me, oh, this is a big deal, right? Is there anybody here who doesn't get this? Please take a moment to reflect. I mean, this is big stuff. I mean, I have to say that. I mean, it's very simple, but this is transforming. If you want, you know, to stop suffering in your life. And if you want to stop causing suffering to others. I mean, here it is. And showing us that it's not, you know, most people think, whew, you know, spiritual path, this is hard stuff. Right? Thank God I heard about rebirth, you know, in many lifetimes. Right? I mean, I'm going to need, you know, that's very reassuring, isn't it? To know that if I don't get it right in this lifetime, you know, I can maybe get it right in the next lifetime. If I don't get it right in the next lifetime, I could probably get it a little better, and then the following lifetime, maybe do. You know what I mean? We kind of, and he's saying, no, it's simple. You know? It's simple. You're already a Buddha. But you don't see clearly. Don't identify clearly. You identify with self. And just to show you how easy it is, he shows you in the same situation how you would respond totally, you know, over here, you're impartial, you're wise, you're objective, you know what I'm saying, right? You already have that innate wisdom in you, that innate clarity. It's everybody here has it. Except when it comes to who? To me. So this identification with self is called in Buddhism, and he's calling it very clearly, delusion. Is there somebody that could define delusion. What's a delusion? Somebody's deluded. We're deluded. We believe something that is not true is true. Or a delusion is, we identify, we see something that's not there. We're deluded. And yet, at the same time, we have this innate clarity, right? This innate wisdom, which again, we all demonstrate when it comes to anybody else. So again, like a good scientist, he goes, same situation, two different outcomes, right? Can you see? He's just a scientist, right? He goes, two different, same situation, two different outcomes. What are the variables that make it different? Why does this have a good outcome and this doesn't? Why am I calm, objective, impartial, wise here, and a total, raving maniac over here? Oh, the only difference is self. Take out self, and you get the same outcome. Right? Put self into it, I end up just like my neighbor. Right? I end up just like the person who's telling me the story that I'm so wise and objective about. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Anybody ever been kind of disappointed in themselves because they know better? Come on. Everybody's going to raise their hand. Isn't it right? See, we know better. That's true. We know better. But the problem is we don't live from that knowing. The knowing is intellectual. So we know better, but we really don't know better. Because if we really knew better, we wouldn't do it, right? So we say, I should have known better, or I know better, but the truth is we don't know better. If we knew better, we would have done differently. It's hard for us to acknowledge that even though we may be smart, and even though we may be spiritual, and even though, blah, 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 we meditate and we do all the right things, we don't know better. It hasn't gotten in here. We still identify with the world of self. The I, me, mine. Because the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating. Now what does that mean? It means that our natural awareness sees, is aware. It illuminates everything that arises. When thoughts arise, it's aware. When sights arise, it's aware. When sounds arise, it's aware. When feelings arise, it's aware. When memories arise, it illuminates everything. Because the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, the traces of everything you've done are spontaneously reflected in it. It's when you attach to these reflected traces that you produce delusions. So now he's kind of going deep. This is something that in Buddhist meditation we get into. Okay. So, because the traces of our past actions of body, speech, and mind are still present within our mind, and when they come up, when our thoughts come up, when our impulses come up, when our desires come up, when our, we call it reactivity comes up, when those things come up, we do what? We attach to them. Attached to them. We treat them as if they're real and not just reflections. Originally, thoughts have no substance. Now, for many people, that is a radical statement. Again, there's lots in Buddhist meditation, once the mind has become settled and concentrated, where we look into these. These are the things we look into. But for many people, the idea that thoughts have no substance is a thought. That no one has ever had. Because for most of us, our thoughts about things, ourselves, life, everything, are what rule us. We treat our thoughts as if they're things, right, that have substance. He's saying, originally, thoughts have no real substance. They're just things that are reflected in mind awareness. So now he gives you, you know, if you say, well, okay, so you might have been saying, okay, I follow you so far, but what do I do now, right? Because I have this history of delusion and misidentification and my anger and my fears and my this and my that. You know, what do I do when they arise? He said, first of all, see them. There's just simply reflections. They're impressions that are left in your mind from the past. They have no substance. So if they're reflected, he says, just let them be reflected. I mean, this is a very deep practice. Sounds easy. And this is sort of what we were doing this morning when the instructions were what? Just let things come and go. Let your thoughts come and go. Let your feelings come and go. Let sounds come and go. Don't grasp at them. Don't grab onto them. Don't push them away. Originally, thoughts have no substance. So if they're reflected, just let them be reflected. If they arise, let them arise. If they stop, let them stop. As long as you're not attaching to these reflective traces, delusions will not be produced. See a reflection in the water, right? And many times, and you know, water can, we can see something almost perfectly reflected in water, right? Everybody know what I'm talking about? It's almost perfect. Let's say there's a beautiful mango tree full of ripe mangoes reflected in the water, and you see them, and you're hungry. Do you reach into the water to eat one? And you laugh. Why do you laugh? Because you know it's just a reflection. But they're not real. What if our thoughts are just reflections in our mind and have no real solid substance? As long as you're not attaching to these reflective traces, delusions will not be produced. So long as you're not attaching to them, you won't be deluded. And then no matter how many traces are reflected, it will be just as if they weren't reflected at all. Even if 100 or 1,000 thoughts spring up, it will just be the same as if they never arose. It won't be any problem for you. No thoughts to clear away. No thoughts to cut off. So understand this well. I mean, this is it. In Buddhism, we call this pith teachings. You know, anybody been around Buddhism? Lots of teachings. Lots of philosophy, psychology, lots of practices. But he's given us the pith in very simple language. Source of the problem? Self, ego, I, me, mine. Stop identifying. Be objective. Impartial, the same way you are with everybody else. And what do you do about your own stuff? Everybody have stuff? Just let it be. Don't grasp at it. Don't attach to it. It's just reflections. Reflections of the past. That's all it is. Reflections in the mirror. Reflections in the water. Just let it be. Just take a moment. Just take a moment, close your eyes a second, and just take it in. You know, what is this, you know, what is Bhanke saying to us? First of all, check to see whether you, you know, kind of understand what he's saying, just in his language. Don't interpret it. What is he saying? And does it make sense to you? I mean, I think that's the second thing. You know, do you think he's right? Or what he's saying is true? I mean, it's not a matter of whether you're able to practice it or not, but, you know, the first thing, what is he saying? And does it make sense to you? You think he could be right? I mean, really ask yourself that. Do I understand what he's saying? And could he be right? What he's saying? That I have this original mind. That I was born with this original mind. That all the things that have happened have conditioned this mind. And the fundamental cause of all this conditioning is this belief in self, being self-centered. That's what supports the show, so to speak, of self. And I need to let go of self-centeredness as a way of living and trust my original Buddha mind, natural, spontaneous awareness mind. And all the things that continue to arise in my mind that are tinged with self, tinged with delusion, tinged with affliction, I just let them go. I don't attach, I don't grab, I don't cut off, I don't push away, but I don't indulge. I just rest in my original mind. See how that, you know, just try it out. Just try it out for a minute. Does it make sense to you? Could it really be this simple? So anybody having a problem with this doesn't make sense to them. What he's saying, or it makes sense to you, but you don't see a way out the way he gives us a way out. Yes. Okay. P-I-T-H. I-T-H. P as in Paul. It's sort of like the pit. You know, like from the pit is the seed, and from that little pit, the whole tree comes. So like a pith teaching is, it's very small, but very compact, and it has lots of potential in it. Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, is this being recorded? That's why you keep doing that. Okay. You were just trying to harass me, or something, distract me. Yeah, so the question is, delusional mind has a meaning in psychiatry, and I'm using, or Bankei is using that term, is there a difference in it? It sort of means the same, but it is a vast difference. Because when psychiatry talks about delusion, they're kind of, the norm is kind of this, you see? And anybody who goes way outside the norm in their delusions, right? They think they're God, or they think they're Jesus, or they think they're Mary, or they think they're, I don't know who, Fred, or they think they're, well, no, see, that's, we'll get to that one. So this is, but you see, right, in psychiatry, it's like big time, you know, it's like you really have a delusion about, you have delusions of grandeur, or delusions that you're somebody, you know. So that's a delusion, and delusions in psychiatry, they're primarily, it's not only also about delusion, but it's about dysfunction. Right? The person's delusion causes them to not function, right? So it's in psychiatry, like, this is normal and that's really abnormal. It's abnormal psych. Okay. From a Buddhist point of view, all of this is abnormal. Okay? We're all, you see, they're using delusion involving everyone. We're all deluded. In the same way, it has the same meaning, which is means we identify ourselves with something that's not true and real. What is that? With self. So, from a Buddhist, in terms of Buddhist psychology, which is a non-self Buddha mind-based psychology, basically, all of kind of normal human life is fundamentally deluded, right? So we might say that, as opposed to like in the West, where the mental health system is very specific, Buddhism is a mental health system for everyone. Okay, it's kind of like, there's no criteria. You know, if you go to a mental health place and you try to get treatment, they'll, you know, assess you and interview you and make sure you meet criteria to get admitted. In Buddhism, everybody meets the criteria. So in that sense, it's very democratic, you know. Is that clear? Yeah. But it's the same term. But and I think understanding that term in a kind of Western psychiatric way gives you a sense, oh, well, this is much more pervasive, much more significant. Yeah, but it's the same idea. Yes. it's all the same. You know, I mean, if you're in addiction, I mean, oftentimes I tell people, you know, there is a recovery movement for addicts, right? And it has its 12-step program, right? Buddhism is like a recovery movement for everyone. Okay? So, I mean, you know, outside of the specifics of addiction, you know, the physiology of it, you know, it has particular, in a certain sense, underlying it is the same thing, right? Like you say, we have impulses, we have desires, right? We have needs, we have wants, we have thoughts. I need this, I must have this, right? I can't live without this. Now, when they arise in the mind, if you treat them as if they're real, right? If you treat them, if you treat your thoughts as if they're giving you real information, then you will tend to what? Follow them or struggle with them, right? But either way, you're treating them as if they're solid, real things. So what he's saying, thoughts, impulses, desires, memories have no substance. Do you believe that? Okay. So what he's saying is, how do you actualize that? Is that when they arise, just look at them. When you look, you know, when you stop and you look at a desire, what do you see? Okay. Yeah, so the practice is, well, first you have to have some mindfulness, like we did today. Right? Like you say, I mean, it sounds good, but how do you do it? Doing it is not that easy. Why? Because we are so enmeshed. Like, if you were an addict, do addicts, when they're in their addiction, have a lot of clarity about what's going on? No. Why? Because they're totally enmeshed in it. It seems very real to them, doesn't it? Right? So they have to be able to get some objectivity. Right? Now, for most addicts, the objectivity comes from sobriety. Right? Then you begin to get some perspective on addiction. Right? And yourself as an addict. It's very hard to have that perspective when you're in it. Now, the lucky thing about meditation and mindfulness is that one can develop the capacity to observe oneself. Right? So, like, what are we doing this morning? I mean, when you're learning to meditate, you're learning to observe your processes, right? One, because you have an anchor. Could be anything, but you know, let's say your anchor is mindfulness of the breath and the body. You have an anchor, right? Somewhere to hold your attention and your awareness. So as thoughts, feelings, perceptions arise, you can see them. Right? But you have an anchor. When you're an addict, you have no anchor. Right? So you have an anchor and you have the capacity now of looking objectively at what's arising, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories, whatever it is. And over time, you develop the capacity to simply see them as what he says, as simply reflections in the mirror of mind. But it, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. But it certainly, you know, it is the path of liberation. That's why meditation is so essential in the Buddhist path, because it answers exactly your questions, like, how do you do it? Sounds great. Makes perfect sense. You know, unfortunately, you know, as my thoughts, feelings, whatever arise, I'm swept away by them. Right? That's the problem. So it's only through developing, you know, that kind of meditative stability, which is not that hard. It just takes practice. Right? One can then do it. I mean, does that make sense? So Bunke says, looking around me, I see that we have an even larger crowd than usual this morning. So probably a lot of you didn't hear the talk I just gave. And again, they say he gives lots of talks. And if you could imagine, I mean, I wear this little thing. I mean, so when they say 500, 1,000, 1,500 people in the talk, unless he was shouting, you know, I mean, when I hear these kind of numbers, you know, in those times, you go, wow. And everybody could hear him? Either people had great hearing back then, or they talked very loudly. It's always been an interesting question to me. I mean, sometimes it's like thousands of people were there, and I go, really? Especially when they were like outdoors and stuff. But anyhow, so he says, so all those who heard the earlier talk I gave, please should leave and give their places to those who didn't. What a nice guy. So those present changed places and seated themselves. A certain man came forward to ask a question that he wished to ask the master. So it gives again a little sense of how he worked. You know, he'd have a crowd of people, but people would ask him questions. And the man says, in your sermons, you always state that getting into bad habits in life, we switch the Buddha mind for evil thoughts. Hearing you, I realize that doing this is wrong. Still, I am a townsman. My business is trade. And things people say make me angry and annoyed. All right? Is that everybody identifying with this man? We don't have to be tradesmen, but anybody here find other people often annoying? Do the actions of other people often make you angry? All right. Okay. Now he says, inside me, I don't harbor any evil thoughts of anger and annoyance. But other people often get me angry. I mean, is that clear? I mean, I'm not an angry person. But these people are annoying. Right? I mean, anybody would get angry, wouldn't you? See, I mean, I just want to let you know, nothing's changed. All right? But other people get me angry, whether it's my wife, my children, etc. But after hearing your sermon, I realized that doing this was wrong and tried to put an end to it. But if I stop those angry thoughts, they only come up again. And there's no end to them at all. What can I do then to stop them? So very practical, right? Sort of like your question. The master replied, the fact is you want to get angry, so you're getting yourself mad. If you hadn't the least angry thought or bad thought to begin with, no matter how others tried to provoke you, you wouldn't get angry. So he's given a basic Buddhist principle that, you know, it comes from within. You know, there had to be the seeds of anger within us already, or nobody could get us angry, nobody get us annoyed. Right? So he's doing a fundamental, in terms of Buddhist psychology, that the source of all feelings, positive and negative, are within our own mind. They're not outside us. Right? Nobody can make us angry. People just do things. Anger is in the mind. Is that clear? Happiness is in the mind. I mean, it's all. That's why, you know, Buddhist psychology and Buddhist practice put so much stress on the mind, because that's really the source of happiness and sorrow. But if in you feelings of anger and annoyance have already been formed, that even though the other people don't set out to deliberately to say things to make you mad, unbelievable. We think they do, don't we? Right? He says, no. You know, they're not going out of their way to make you angry. You get carried away by the force of your own self-centeredness. Lose your temper and insist, I don't say anything that's untrue or improper. Right? We call that what? Self-righteousness, right? Anybody ever been angry? Has anybody ever been angry and at the same time felt that they weren't right? No. When we're angry, we think we're absolutely right. That's what he's saying. I mean, So for those who think that's sort of, you know, you're a modern phenomenon, please understand this is ancient. So you get carried away by the force of your own self-centeredness, etc. Lose your temper, insist, I don't say anything that's untrue or improper. And thus you create your own karma. So, to try to stop your rising thoughts, holding back and suppressing them is a bad idea. The original innate Buddha mind is one alone. It is never two. Another fundamental teaching of Buddhism. Many people think they have multiple minds, right? Again, it's interesting. Western psychiatry, we talk about what? Multiple personalities. And we call that what? Really sick. But most of us think, you know, I have within me, I have the good side and the bad side, right? I have the spiritual side and the material side, right? You know what I'm saying? So if you think about it, we carry on with the same deluded belief, like we have multiple minds, multiple selves, right? And many people, you know, quote unquote normal people, right? We have within themselves a kind of war going on. Anybody know that? Between their good self and their bad self. The self they want to be and the self they don't want to be. Right? Between their spiritual self and their material self. Right? Between their sensual self. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, right? The mind of this, the mind of that, the self of this, the self of that. So we are like unintegrated people who kind of perceive that we have all these different minds within us and mind states within us, and they're all warring for dominance, right? And so we decide what? I'm going to take a stand, right? I am no longer going to allow that angry mind at all, right? Can you see it, right? We decide we're gonna line up with the non-angry mind, right? And we're gonna put a stop to the angry mind. So we hold back and suppress. The original innate Buddha mind is one alone. It is never two. So this is important. We only have one mind. We don't have two minds. We don't have three. Or four, or five, or six, or ten. We have one mind. And our original mind is our Buddha mind. The original innate Buddha mind is one alone. But when you try to stop your rising anger, your mind is split between your angry thoughts and your thoughts of stopping them. So this is not a battle of minds, right? This is a battle that is going on within your own mind. And what is it a battle of? Thoughts. Competing thoughts. Right? The angry thought that wants to express itself, and the other thoughts that saying, don't express yourself. Shut up. Right? Don't say anything. Right? So, you know, okay. So we're split. It's as if you're chasing after someone who's running away. Except you're both the runner and the one pursuing him as well. He's really wonderful. You know what I mean? We're both. Right? With the thoughts that are running away and with a person chasing after the thought. We're both of them. When you know that, then working with your thoughts is not that hard. But if you don't understand that and you think you have two different minds and different kinds of thoughts and you got to corral the one, and you see, then you got a lot of work. You know, so a lot of people, you know, when we do our basic mindfulness groups here and introduce, you know, many people just have a hard time just being present to themselves. Did you know that? I mean, maybe you find that in your own meditation, that when certain types of thoughts or feelings or memories come up, your first response is what? What? Push it away. Why? Because you don't like those, having those thoughts, do you? You see? We reject those thoughts. We're not comfortable with those thoughts. We don't identify as somebody who should have those type of thoughts, right? Yeah, not us, you see, because I identify with what? The good mind. Not the bad mind. That's who? I mean, who is that? Unless you think you have multiple minds, right? We only have one mind. And in that one mind, we have many thoughts and feelings and perceptions and memories that are all just coming from our conditioning. That's all that's going on. Let me give you an example of what I mean. You can busy yourself sweeping under a tree with thick autumn foliage, but since the tree's leaves will keep scattering down from above, even if for the moment you manage to get everything neatly swept away, more leaves will only come falling later on, won't they? So you see, his examples are always, right? You know, just, right? Anybody know what I mean? You know? Somebody who blows, you know, your sidewalks and something, you know. Especially this type of year when the oak leaves are, you know, what do you find? There you go. At the end, it's what? Perfect. You even got that last acorn and leaf. You go inside feeling very what? Proud, happy. And you wake up the next day and what do you see? Right? More leaves. Yeah. In the same way, even if you stop your original thought of anger, the subsequent thought involved with the stopping of them will never come to an end. This is why, like in this morning, the instruction was given, don't struggle with your thoughts. Don't try to stop them. That's not what this is about. Because you can't stop them. Because it's the nature of the thinking mind to think. Right? It's the nature of leaves to fall. It's the nature of dishes to get dirty. Right? Isn't that true? It's just the nature of things. So when you understand that, you're not trying to stop. Because when you try to stop, you're entering into a struggle. Right? Now remember what we called this meditation this morning? We called it calm abiding, tranquility meditation. So we're practicing this meditation so to develop a calm mind. But if inside you're struggling, right, to suppress your thoughts, you're getting yourself what? Agitated. So how can you have a calm mind? So the idea of trying to stop your thoughts is wrong. Since that's how it is, when you no longer bother about these rising thoughts, not trying either to stop them or not to stop them, that's the unborn Buddha mind. That's what I've been telling you about in such detail. Weren't you listening? And if you weren't, what a shame. So, you know, a little tough guy there. You know, kind of going, you know, weren't you listening to what I've been saying? Of course, many of us are present, but we don't hear what's being said to us because we're really not listening deeply, are we? Because even as we're listening to a talk, we are thinking about what we're hearing. Right? Let me say that again. So even though we're here to listen to a talk and absorb, instead, as the talk is being presented, we are what? We are thinking about it, churning, and we wonder why it never gets in, right? Why we have to keep going, you know, buy the latest self-help book, buy the latest spiritual book, buy the latest Dharma book, right? Why? I mean, it doesn't say much different than the last one we read, Well, the one we probably read 10 years ago, I mean, it's kind of simple, right? Why doesn't it get in? Because we're journey. I won't get to it today. We have to stop. But there's a great analogy of Bankei where he talks about using thoughts to clean up your thoughts. He uses the analogy, it's like there's blood, you know, there's a blood stain. And so you go and get a bucket of blood and you dip your rag in the blood and then you clean the stain. I mean, it's a great, you know, and he goes, and he said, and you're doing that thinking that somehow you're cleaning up the blood. And he says, trying to, you know, get rid of thoughts with thoughts is like that. Right. So it is now just about 12:30. This is the end of the Dharma talk. At 12:30 there'll be lunch. And for those of you who've been here before, you know that you know, we maintain silence and we practice what we call mindful eating, which means we are present to what we're eating. We see it, we smell it, we taste it, right? And we're present to the people around us. We can look at each other, we can appreciate each other, we can notice each other without having to think about each other. So it's learning how to be present, and there'll be a little rest. 12:30 to 1:30, then at 1:30 there's mindful movements. Who's doing mindful movements? Who? Carrie's doing mindful movements from 1:30 to 1:50, then there'll be guided meditation. And I'm sure you know what to focus on. We'll be sort of, doing some of these practices that Bankei was talking about. Then there'll be walking meditation. Then there'll be a short silent meditation. Then I'll be here and we'll do a final meditation together and I'll answer your questions. We'll get clear on everything and then we'll have our closing circle and be done about 4 o'clock. So it's really a short day. You know where the bathrooms are. You know, and they can... Out in the garden. Obviously, you're aware we are in the middle. I wish I was in the middle. We're at the early stages of our construction project, and it's kind of walled off. But that's going to be our residence, Great Cloud Refuge, where people are going to be able to stay and be able to do retreats here, and people will be able to come here and stay here. So that hopefully will be done by this summer. So they probably don't want you wandering into it, but you can look at it. So that's what that is for those who are new. So we'll stop now.